WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation about the language of love and a close encounter with electrocution, we talk with novelist A.S. Byatt. Her new novel is Babel Tower. She's also the author of the bestseller Possession and the story Angels and Insects, which was adapted into a film. Also, we meet photojournalists David and Peter Turnley. They're identical twins. They've spent the past 15 years traveling separately and occasionally together to cover the world's trouble spots. A show of their work opens tomorrow at the International Center of Photography. And TV critic David Bianculli tells us about one of his guilty pleasures, the syndicated superheroine show Xena. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Firefighters in Alaska are struggling to gain control of a huge wildfire that has charred more than 40,000 acres so far. The fire has forced hundreds of people from their homes and destroyed dozens of houses in the Big Lake area north of Anchorage. Tricia Umont with the American Red Cross says many evacuees have been housed in a temporary shelter.
We have a shelter set up in Wasilla, Alaska. And last night, we had about 421 people staying at that shelter. It's kind of been a community hub or a center for all the evacuees. They've been able to come in and get a meal or see if one of their neighbors that has been missing is located at that Red Cross shelter.
The wildfire is still burning out of control, and it's being fueled by hot, dry, windy weather. Syrian President Hafez al-Assad has invited the leaders of Egypt and Saudi Arabia to a summit meeting in Damascus to discuss the prospects for a Middle East peace in the wake of Benjamin Netanyahu's election victory in Israel. Top Egyptian leaders in Cairo confirmed the meeting. Netanyahu said today that he foresees a number of confidence-building moves with Syria ahead of any full peace agreement. He said his opposition to handing back the Golan Heights in return for a peace deal should not spell an end to diplomatic efforts to improve Israel's relations with Syria. The FBI may soon be cutting off more than just the electricity at the Freeman Ranch in Montana. The New York Times reports today the agency is considering taking further steps to isolate the group, among them disrupting the Freeman satellite TV, cellular telephone, and radio communication signals. In Jordan, Montana, a local rancher will deliver a petition this afternoon calling on the FBI to get tougher with the anti-government group. Mark Roberts reports.
Jordan area rancher Brent McCray says the petition drive has gathered some 200 signatures. McCray plans to submit the petition to Garfield County Sheriff Charles Phipps. He then wants Phipps to present the petition to the FBI. McCray points out the petition supports the efforts of law enforcement authorities.
It further states we believe an ultimatum in terms of time and conditions of surrender need to be given and upheld, and we do accept that reasonable force may be needed to end the standoff.
Today's edition of the Denver Post reports two of the freemen, Edwin Clark and his 21-year-old son Casey, may choose to give up the standoff and surrender to the FBI. I'm Mark Roberts reporting.
Russian and Chechen negotiators struggle today to break a deadlock over withdrawing Russian troops from Chechnya as peace talks on ending the war resumed. The two sides agreed yesterday on ways to exchange prisoners and had hoped to sign a broader agreement today. The talks, which opened Tuesday in southern Russia, were called to try to enforce a ceasefire agreed upon last week. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 7 points at 5,690 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ is down 7 points. This is NPR News. New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato is facing allegations that he got some special treatment recently from a New York stock brokerage firm. A report by the Securities and Exchange Commission says in a single deal in 1993, D'Amato realized a $37,000 profit in one day. The report does not allege any wrongdoing, but it says the deal does raise questions about the brokerage firm's motives. D'Amato now chairs the Senate Banking Committee, which oversees banking and financial interests. D'Amato hasn't commented on the SEC report, but in the past he has denied being aware of being given special treatment in his stock dealings. The Senate is scheduled to vote later today on a constitutional balanced budget amendment. This is the second time Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole has brought the measure to the floor, and he's expected to come up short with votes once again. NPR's Peter Kenyon has more.
For one of the final votes of his Senate career, Dole selected not only a politically charged issue, but one that requires a two-thirds majority for passage. He came within one vote last March, but since then he's lost ground. Republicans will have to content themselves with bashing Democrats for claiming to support a balanced budget while voting against the amendment. Idaho Republican Larry Craig said it's a time-honored strategy.
When you're losing the argument, concede on the principle and continue to fight over the details.
Democrats say instead of wasting time on the balanced budget amendment, Dole should be pushing for a bipartisan health care bill. They threatened to try and attach it to this amendment, but held off to give Republicans more time to try and work out a compromise. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
President Clinton has announced a $200 reduction in closing costs for homes bought with government-backed FHA loans. The discount will apply to about 100,000 first-time homebuyers a year. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new drug to help glaucoma patients fight blindness. But the medication has one unusual side effect. The drug can turn blue eyes brown. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Advanta, a financial services provider to consumers and small businesses, and the presenting sponsor of the Cezanne exhibition, now through September 1st at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, British writer A.S. Byatt, is the author of the 1991 novel Possession. The book was a surprise bestseller in the States and also won England's most prestigious literary award, the Booker Prize. Part detective story, part academic novel, part parody, it was about two scholars who are each researching a Victorian poet. The academics discover their respective Victorian poets were lovers, and then the academics fall in love with each other. Byatt's short story, Angels and Insects, was adapted into the recent film of the same name. She has a new novel called Babel Tower. As the title suggests, the novel is about language and how it is often used to divide us. Set in the 1960s, the story revolves around a literary critic named Frederica and two court cases. Frederica is suing her husband for divorce, while a novel written by an acquaintance is being prosecuted on obscenity charges. I asked Byatt what got her thinking about how divisive language can be.
The idea was, I think, that in the 1960s when this book is set, I felt that language was somehow flying apart, that there were all sorts of people speaking little closed languages to each other. They were speaking, the language of sociology was coming in. And then I had a friend who was appearing in the trial of Last Exit to Brooklyn, to whom I was talking about the difficulties of writing a petition for divorce because the language didn't fit your life as you were trying to describe it. And he said, that's exactly how I feel about trying to be a literary expert in a law court, talking about an obscene book or a possibly obscene book. And that gave me the idea of a plot which would centre on language. I've also always been interested in language and the teaching of language and the teaching of reading and writing at every level from 5 years old to adults. And that has got in as a theme in the novel.
And what was your life like in the 1960s? What were you up to?
I had two small children, one of them born in 1960 and one in 1961, I think. And I had just moved from the north of England, which was, in my case, Durham, to London. And I taught various sorts of people part-time. I taught 2 days a week in an art college. I taught literature as a subsidiary study to painters and potters and industrial designers and jewellers and textile designers and all sorts of interesting people, which gave me a sort of window, I think, on what the student life of the 60s was, because I was a bit old for it. And my first marriage came apart. It came apart quite amiably, unlike the marriage in the novel.
Frederica, the main character in your new novel, is filing for a divorce and trying to put her grievances into words. She's a professor and literary critic. Why is this so problematic for her, putting her grievances into words for the court?
Because the courts have an extremely rigid way in which things can be expressed. It's actually very comic. I think there's a kind of mad, bitter comedy about the kind of language into which lawyers turn the things that you say. And it's partly because in those days, divorce was extremely adversarial. You couldn't be divorced without there being a matrimonial fault. And this meant that, in fact, anyone who wanted amiably to get divorced had to invent all sorts of faults, which caused you to write fiction and lies. And, of course, fiction is my business.
Since your novel is so much about language, I'm interested in parts of language that you love the most. I know you're very interested in Victorian literature, and I wonder what particularly interests you about the language of the Victorian period.
I think it's the richness, really, the variety of it, and also the fact that the sentences can be long and complicated and beautiful. I say quite often that a good modern style, it's very hard for it to be ornamental. It has to be plain and clear, like V.S. Naipaul at his best. He writes these strange, questing sentences that are almost tacked together and sort of jewel-like and precise. The Victorians could be perfectly precise, but they could also be flamboyant, and they wrote wonderful metaphors. And the other thing I love about the Victorians is that the scientific sensibility and the religious sensibility and the philosophical sensibility and the sense of people living their lives weren't flown apart as I feel they are now. Though I think actually we're living through a time when it's coming back again. One of the things I really like about now is that we're getting these great popularising scientists who write brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And they remind me of the great Victorians. They have the same drive to explain.
You know, when you're talking about how ornamental some Victorian writing is, I sometimes think that we're kind of too busy and impatient for ornamental literature now.
Well, we aren't, or they wouldn't sell when they happen. I mean, look at Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose. Why should a book which has almost no sex in it, is very, very complicated, contains a great deal of medieval theology, and is very ornamentally written in very many styles, why should a book like that become a world bestseller? And it's partly because he does his readers the honour of of showing them the intricacy of how language can work. And I didn't. I thought Possession might do quite well because it, you know, it's a good detective story. It's two good love stories. But the response that I have had to the complicated language of Possession from readers in this country and all over the world, because it's been translated into complicated French and to complicated German, has quite staggered me. I think we have a hunger for beautiful languages. We have a hunger for beautiful colours and paint and for complicated dancing.
Mm-hmm. Your novel Possession, in part, compared the language of Victorian writing and Victorian expressions of love to today. What interests you in how Victorians wrote about love?
Well, they believed it mattered. I think they did have a religious sense of what love was. The religious life of Victorian England and the religious life of 19th century France, and certainly the religious life of 19th century America, was completely involved with what people thought they were, even if they were very daring atheists who were rejecting the religious frameworks. So the word love had this sort of absolute, powerful feel to it, because it also meant the love of God, and it was what human beings were for. And what I was trying in Possession to contrast that with was a sense that one of my eldest daughter once said to me, you know, about the man she lives with. She said, I know I love him, but of course we wouldn't use the word because it's become devalued. And it had become devalued, I think, by lots and lots of romantic fiction and by a kind of psychoanalytic analysing and analysing of people's emotions so that you can't say anything simply. And the Victorians, I think, were quite terrified of the love they felt, as well as in awe of it.
Have you felt comfortable using the language of love in life, or is it more comfortable to use it in literature? I mean, have you ever written passionate love letters, or is that the kind of thing you would only do in fiction form?
I have written passionate love letters, but after a time, a kind of self-parody and a kind of self-mockery gets into it, not, I think, because of the woman I am, but because of the writer I am. Because one of the terrible things about people's passionate love letters is that every single person's passionate love letter resembles everybody else's. It is not one of the areas in which you, on the whole, say something new or strange. You go down a very fine channel, and you always feel that you're the only person that's ever been there. In fact, almost everybody's been there. So love letters are quite difficult to write. It's very interesting if you read anthologies of love letters. The great ones are often written by people about to be executed, and they're really death letters, and they're suddenly somebody trying to tell somebody that they really care about them, even there, even in the tower, about to be executed. Whereas the sort of feeling of waking up and realising, oh, my God, there is somebody in my life who has become absolutely all important to me and I can't see anybody else because they're in the way of them. It's partly wonderful, and partly it's a kind of machinery and there's an end to it. I think what I really like is writing letters to somebody you really know and love, who is interested in every little thing you think and say. But when you start saying, I love you this way and I love you that way, how do I love you? Let me count the ways, as Elizabeth Barrett Browning said. I think you quite quickly become a bit boring, at least to the writer in yourself.
Did you ever get a love letter and think, well, this is a cliche, this isn't really very interesting, the writing isn't very good?
I've had both sorts, yes. I had a most wonderful love letter from a man I didn't like at all. And what do you do about that?
What did you do about that?
I put it in a drawer and got on with my life.
Right.
But I remember the letter, you see. I remember his letter, and I can hardly remember his face.
Well, do you remember it by heart?
Well, it began with quoting a poem by Carey. I think it's Carey, one of the 17th century poets, about at last, you know, I've found the not impossible she that shall possess my heart and me. And I'd always wanted somebody to write me a letter that began with that quote, and this completely wrong man did. He was a very beautiful man, but you could see from sort of the other side of a room that he was very dangerous and not the sort of person you should ever get to know. And he drew a great big blue hand his own hand over this letter. I've probably still got it somewhere, but I don't know where. I never consciously threw it away. I just lost it, which is what I always do with letters.
You know what you're saying about how so many expressions of love kind of become cliché? It's very frustrating if you feel you can't rise above that, because that leaves you two choices. One is to try to express yourself and get stuck in clichés, and the other is to be mute.
Well, the third is irony, really. I was talking about Umberto Eco a bit ago, and there's a famous thing he says that bears repeating. He said, you know, in our ironic postmodern world, you can't go and say to a woman, I love you passionately, madly, deeply. He says, but you can put it in context by saying, as Barbara Cartland would say, I love you passionately, madly, deeply. And he says, then the woman has been told, A, that you're far too sophisticated to utter this cliche, but nevertheless you have uttered it with your ironic disclaimer. And she knows you love her. He says, you've got it always that way. But I don't quite like doing it that way either. What I do like to do in a novel, which is why love in novels is better than life, I like love to hit people when they weren't expecting it, which is a nice thing to do in fiction.
A.S. Byatt is my guest. She has a new novel. It's called Babel Tower. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with A.S. Byatt, her new novel is called Babel Tower. Do you feel your own writing has been influenced by the Victorians?
Yes, it has, not exclusively. Above all by George Eliot. I think George Eliot for me is the greatest English novelist. And it's convenient and good and nice that she's a woman. But that isn't why. I love her because she got everything in. Mm-hmm. She got everything in, from teacups and clothes and what people had for breakfast, through to every little social distinction, and right out into the history of philosophy and the history of European thought, and by the end, the sort of history of Judaism as well. And she expanded the sort of possibilities of the English novel almost infinitely. And Jane Austen is wonderful, but it is a sort of patterned social dance with deep feelings being patterned by this dance of manners. George Eliot puts everything else in as well. She puts fury, she puts passion, she puts intelligence.
You taught English literature for, what, 11 years?
Yes, well, full time. I've been teaching since I was about 22, either full time or part time, but I only taught full time for 11 years.
Right, and so you were, I think, 48 years old when you left the university as a full-time professor to be a more full-time writer. What was the turning point there that made you think, now's the time, I'm going to do it now?
I thought it was because the government was actually paying everybody to take early retirement. And, what happened was that everybody who could do anything else, which meant that a lot of the very interesting people rushed at this money and went off and did something else and put the money in the bank. I mean, my early retirement money is still in the bank because I immediately began to earn a very great deal more by writing after one dreadful and frightening year. But I think deeper than that, I went into teaching full time in order to pay my son's boarding school fees, because I was worried about sending him to the local school, and both my husbands said, if you want him to go to a paying school, you must get a job. So I got a university post. And then he was killed the week I got the post by a car, by a drunk driver. And I stayed with the job I had taken on because it seemed, the formality of the teaching seemed a way of coping with the grief. And my youngest child was born in the January of the academic year I started teaching in. I started teaching in the September My son was killed in the July before that. And I now see, I actually taught until my youngest daughter was exactly as old as my son had been. And that seemed to be the end of that. That seemed to be somehow the end of it.
What do you make of that? You taught for 11 years, the age that your son was when he died.
I think it was to do with my little daughter, really. I think when she got to be beyond 11, that was the end of that phase of my life, if you see what I mean. I think I actually think I was in mourning for 11 years, and teaching was a very good way of living because, I mean, the glory of students is that they're extremely self-centred and you have to pay them attention and you haven't got any time to have feelings about yourself. And then after a bit, I began to see that I could get back to writing more gleefully. And then I began to feel I've got to get out.
A.S. Byatt is my guest. She has a new novel, which is called Babel Tower. I would like you to read a paragraph from your new novel. This is from the beginning. It's not the very beginning, but it's near the beginning of the book. And this is where the main character is telling about her sister's death.
She's telling a young poet she's met by accident. Frederica tells him about her sister's death. He realizes that this narrative is practiced. This is the way she has found it convenient, possible, to tell it. Her sister, she says, was married to a vicar and had two small children. And the cat brought in a bird, a sparrow, which took refuge under the refrigerator, and her sister had pulled it out and reached under it, and the fridge was not properly earthed. She was very young, says Frederica. Afterwards, she says wryly, we all suffered from shock. Shock waves, she says grimly, waves and waves of shock. How terrible, says Hugh Pink, prevented from imagining by Frederica's matter-of-fact tone.
Now, I believe that you were nearly killed in the way that you just described by a refrigerator.
yes, I was. I have a nice, neat, small, square scar on the upper part of the inside of my left arm to prove it.
What happened?
Exactly what happens in the novel. My large cat, which was called Proust, brought in a sparrow. The sparrow got on the top of a cupboard where it just sat all day, and it got to be midnight, and I said, I've got to get this bird out of the kitchen because I've locked the cat out and it can't get in. So I got on a chair and tried to frighten the bird off the cupboard, and it flew under the refrigerator, so I pulled the refrigerator out, and the side of the casing of the refrigerator sort of curved under, and the bird was standing on the edge of this, so when I pulled the refrigerator, the bird went with it. So I lay on the floor and stretched my left arm in, and it was immediately sort of burnt all the way up. The skin was burnt, and I was shaken about. The fridge was obviously not properly earthed. But
grounded is the word we use in America, I think, just to clarify that. Yeah.
Yeah, the fridge was not properly grounded. And my ex-husband, who is nothing if not efficient, turned it off. He turned the switch off. So I was able to retreat rather shaken from under there. And the beautiful bit of this story, which never got into the novel, is that we were then living under the wall of Durham Cathedral, where the venerable Bede is buried. And Bede describes human life in terms of a sparrow, which flies in out of the dark and goes across the lighted room and flies out into the dark. And this damn bird, which was a sparrow, flew out into the dark against the wall of the cathedral under which Bede's tombstone lies. And it was a magical moment, but of course I couldn't put it in the novel because in the novel the character was not in Durham.
Right. But you actually succeeded in freeing the bird.
Yes, it flew away. It really flew out. It flew out and away. I don't know what it did then because it was midnight or by then a bit later. And I did actually think, which interested me a great deal, because I did think, this is it, I'm going to die. And then I thought, what will happen to the children? And it interested me, you know, if you talk about altruism, you always wonder how much you really would put your children first. And at that moment, I did have this complete vision of these two children sleeping quietly upstairs, and what on earth would happen to them.
A.S. Byatt has a new novel called Babel Tower. We'll talk a bit more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from William Morrow, publisher of Kenneth C. Davis's new book, Don't Know Much About the Civil War, Everything You Need to Know About America's Greatest Conflict But Never Learned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, photojournalists David and Peter Turnley. Their travels around the world covering war and revolution are occasionally complicated by the fact that they're identical twins. Also, we continue our conversation with A.S. Byatt, and TV critic David Bianculli shares a guilty pleasure. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with novelist A.S. Byatt. She's the author of the bestseller Possession and the short story Angels and Insects, which was adapted into a film of the same name. Her new novel is called Babel Tower. In an interview you did for the New York Times, you said that you didn't speak to anyone voluntarily until you were about 16. And I found that really interesting since you're so obsessed with language, the fact that you felt so uncomfortable speaking.
I used to read. I think partly the reason I was uncomfortable speaking was that I had a sort of enormous vocabulary, which until I started speaking, I assumed everybody had. You know, people used to look at me oddly when I spoke to them because I would talk as though I was just reading, coming out of a novel by Sir Walter Scott. Or, this is a slight joke, but it's partly a truth as well. And it's also, actually, I don't know quite where I got it from. I think my mother had a kind of social fear. I did expect to be unacceptable as a person, and I don't know where that came from.
So were you very, you must have friends, right?
Not a lot. I had one or two. Mm-hmm. And I was never quite really sure they were my friends, and I had a sort of philosophical and provisional sense that at any moment they might cease to be my friend. I had one friend who is now dead, to whom I dedicated Still Life because she was the original of Stephanie. But I don't know. I mean, I think I could also truthfully say that the life inside books was much richer and more interesting than most of the conversations you had with girls at school about crushes on other girls or hockey or what, you know, what was wrong with the teachers.
So what changed for you when you were 16 that made you more verbal?
I don't know. 16 is the right age, really. Mm-hmm. I think I spoke even less at 16. I think what made me more verbal was going to Cambridge, was going to university, was finding myself in a verbal world where lots of people, not just me, most people, I thought, cared about thinking, expected to talk about interesting, complicated things. And I thought I might not be such an oddity, and I wasn't. I mean, there were a lot of people just like me. It was great. And the other thing, of course, is that I did find and do find men easy to talk to. I think because my father was much easier to talk to than my mother, if he was ever there.
Mm-hmm. Your sister, Margaret Drabble, is also a celebrated novelist. Are there parts of your lives that you shared, like from childhood, that you've both written about in really different ways?
I don't think we read each other's novels. I read one of hers. I mean, I read about the first three of hers, and then I had a horrible experience, which I will describe. If you're a writer, you collect certain things which glitter at you, which you know are going to be parts of novels. And there was a peculiarly, I then thought, ugly, bright yellow vase, which moved around from room to room in the houses we lived in. And I was always going to put this vase, because I think because its proportions were wrong, into a novel. It was too bright, it was too bright a yellow. And then to my horror, I found this vase sitting in a novel by my sister and saw that I couldn't have it. And this revealed to me that there would be and were all sorts of other deeper and more important things that if I read them in her book, I would never be able to write. So we then had an agreement that we wouldn't read each other's books. I mean, we did actually sort of talk to each other about this, and we sort of thought we would. And she, when she was doing the Oxford Companion to English Literature, felt impelled to have to read The Virgin in the Garden because she was putting in my generation of writers, they're not hers. So she wrote me a letter saying, I have had to read The Virgin in the Garden because, you see, I couldn't do the... and I have to tell you, I think it is a very, very good novel. And I thought it was terribly nice of her to write me this letter. but I knew exactly why she hadn't read it before. and we go along quite well but like that. I mean, there may be other vases.
I can really understand this. I really can. Though I imagine you're also dying of curiosity at the same time.
Partly. Every now and then I pick one of hers up in a bookstore and read six or seven pages to see if I come across something I recognize by accident.
Uh-huh.
And I did once. I sort of came across one of her characters saying, everybody describes me as a nice woman. What can be more boring than to be described as a nice woman? And I thought, exactly, exactly. But mostly I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and I read a bit once where she described a woman who got out of a car into a flyover, into a motorway where you shouldn't be on foot. And I thought it was a terribly good bit of writing. But then I put the book down in the bookshop and got on with whatever I was doing.
Right. We only have about a minute left. I have one more question I want to ask you. Why have you chosen to use A.S.? By it as your writing name instead of your full name?
It's complicated, really. It just struck me as being what you did when I started writing. I think largely because of a sort of passionate admiration for T.S. Eliot.
Mm.
And I don't think I wanted to be thought not to be a woman, but I do think that even then I didn't want to be a woman novelist, you know, with capital letters. And I think to that extent it was an attempt not at not being a woman, but at some sort of anonymity. And then in the 60s, when I had my small children and I got very gloomy and thought, you're never going to write a novel, I thought I would call my eldest daughter Antonia and she could write the novel. And this has been really a very, very silly thing to do. She's now a very beautiful woman and runs the South Bank Literature Department in London. She runs the whole literary readings there very brilliantly. And she, as far as I'm concerned, is Antonia Byatt, and I am A.S. And my grandchildren address me as A.S. They ring me up on the telephone and say, A.S., are you there? And that is how I think of myself now.
Well, that's interesting. But your full name is Antonia.
Yeah, Antonia Susan.
Oh, very interesting. I thank you so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
A.S. Byatt's new novel is called Babel Tower. Coming up, identical twin photojournalists Peter and David Turnley. This is Fresh Air. Tomorrow, the International Center of Photography in New York opens a new show featuring the work of photojournalists David and Peter Turnley. They're identical twins who've spent the past 15 years traveling around the world, documenting war, revolution, momentous events, and daily life. Peter is a contract photographer for Newsweek and has had 27 cover photos. He spent several years in Russia documenting the last days of communism and also covered the Gulf War, Bosnia, Somalia, Rwanda, and South Africa. David works for the Detroit Free Press and won a Pulitzer Prize for pictures from Eastern Europe and Tiananmen Square. He was based in South Africa from 85 to 87. The Turnley brothers have independent careers, but occasionally they turn up in the same place at the same time. When they do, they often team up, because as Peter told me, photojournalists and hotspots often travel in pairs.
I recall working in townships in South Africa. There was a particular time just shortly before the first free elections, when there was some extremely violent skirmishes going on in a township outside of Johannesburg. And my brother David had been working in South Africa since 1986 and knew the terrain certainly better than I did. And I recall as we entered this particular township called Tokoza that I felt particularly more prepared and reassured of the situation, knowing that my brother knew the ins and outs of this area certainly better than I did.
David, what was that like for you?
So often we have found ourselves, and I could use that example, that particular day in Tokoza was in fact the day after one of our very good friends and colleagues, Ken Oosterbrook, a photographer in Johannesburg, had been killed in exactly the same place. It was just before the elections in 1994, and there was continued clashes between Zulus faithful to the Inkatha movement and ANC loyalists. And there were really sort of day-to-day open civil war skirmishes going on in these streets. In those kinds of situations, it's, you know, you have all you can do really to look out for yourself. It's too much to have to look out for someone else. That in itself perhaps can be a paradox in our case, because I'm working with someone who I care for very dearly. But at the same time, I mean, we have, I think, a pretty clear, some real clarity about what we're doing and about the prerequisites and the priorities in those moments. And I can tell you that it leaves me with a sense of calm that I know I don't have to look out for my brother, but at the same time, I have somebody that's watching my back.
Have you ever traveled together through military checkpoints where the people who are passing judgment on you notice that you're identical twins and do a double take?
We have a very, I think it's a rather amusing story. I had been working in Israel for about 3 months at the beginning of the Intifada in 1988. And just in the course of doing my day-to-day work, by doing it the best I could, I ended up often enough in what happened to be closed military zones. And over the course of these 3 months, I suppose I incurred the wrath of several Israeli military officers that had to kick me out of these places. And as I was leaving, my brother was just coming to Israel, and I called him on the phone and I said, David, I just want you to be aware you may encounter some hostility that you won't understand, but you should be prepared for it. And a couple weeks later, I get a call from my brother, and he says, damn it, Peter, I was in this area today. I didn't know where I was. It happened to be a closed military zone. I get arrested by this military officer. He takes me to a station, and is really angry at me. And I explain, excuse me, sir, but you don't understand. I didn't know the rules here. And he said, what do you mean you didn't know the rules? I've been running you out of here for the last 3 months. And my brother said, no, but you don't understand. That's my twin brother. And this particular officer crosses his arms and looks at him and says, now that's an original story.
Now, let me explain that you're both in a studio in New York. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia, so I'm not actually seeing you. How identical are you?
We look a lot alike. If you had never met us before and probably encountered me having a cup of coffee at a cafe in Paris, and then about an hour later, I left and David walked in, you'd have a bit of a double take. You might be a little confused because there'd be a few things that seem different, but it would take you a few seconds to get your bearings straight. David's a little taller than I am. At this particular instant, I have a goatee, David doesn't. It helps people to identify the two of us. But through our lives, we've looked a lot alike. And there have been, another anecdote with respect to that. You asked earlier how often we run into each other while we're in the field. I remember I was in Armenia in 1989 covering the enormous earthquake, and it was one of the most emotional and tragic events I had ever seen, 35,000 people killed, and I was one of the first journalists to this area. And I was in this little town called Spitak one day, and I ran into this was several days after I'd got there, more journalists were arriving. I ran into a French journalist that I knew, and he said, so how was your day in Leninakan yesterday? And I thought to myself, well, I wasn't in Leninakan yesterday. Then suddenly I said to the guy, hey, my brother's here. And I realized that he must have run into my brother the day before.
How did you each get started taking pictures?
We both grew up in the Midwest in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and had both been extremely athletic and played every sport. And when I was 17, I had a rather serious knee injury from a football injury. And suddenly I found myself with a lot more time than I'd ever had after school. And while I was in the hospital, I had the great fortune. My parents had the good taste to offer me a book of photographs by the great French photographer Cartier-Bresson. I remember really marveling at the just the glory of the day-to-day moments that this man had captured and noticed. And so I bought a camera, and a friend of mine who actually had been on the football team taught me the technique of the darkroom, and I began to take pictures for the high school newspaper. And having all this free time after school, I suddenly started after school just walking around all kinds of neighborhoods of my hometown, often neighborhoods where I previously had not really spent a lot of time, particularly inner city neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. Fort Wayne's a very classic American industrial city. I suddenly found how the camera and photography became this really great way to helped me open up my personality. I was tapping into things of, I think, my sensitivities that I hadn't really delved into a lot before. The camera was a wonderful pretext to meet people that I was interested in, to meet new kinds of people. And this has probably throughout my career been a real constant.
David, how did you start taking pictures?
Well, as a twin brother. We grew up as very close friends and did a lot of things that happened to evolve because one of us had fallen into something, and it just seemed it struck me as it did Peter that this was an interesting process that I hadn't previously certainly understood. I remember watching photographers at football games when I played football, thinking, God, that's kind of sad. Don't these guys want to play? They're just sort of standing on the sideline watching. And suddenly the revelation that the camera was this ticket into other people's lives. It was a way to be creative. It was also a way to sort of scream about things that you see with your eyes that you want people to know about.
Was it awkward for you, David, at first, starting to take pictures after your brother had started? Did it feel like me too?
No, not at all. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, that's the beauty of any creative process. It's certainly not exclusive to any of us.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me, you both started as being very athletic. In a way, you've kind of combined adventure and photography by being photojournalists for so long.
Well, there's undoubtedly a very physical nature to photojournalism. You're often in difficult conditions, difficult terrain. There's a lot of running involved. You walk a lot. You often enough carry sort of heavy equipment. And I've always found that the sort of sense of discipline and drive that I knew from athletics has been a real help in photography. It happens so frequently that it's just that sort of like in athletics, I guess, I think if you do them well, that it's that extra step that you make when you were tired and you would have just as soon sort of taken your helmet off and sat on the bench, that when you discover a wonderful moment that you otherwise wouldn't have seen.
I know you grew up near the Indiana Speedway and used to hang out there a lot when you were kids or teenagers. Does that figure into your work at all, into the direction that you headed in?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know how you knew that, but I think it actually does in a interesting or funny kind of way. We lived about four blocks from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway when we were both 8 years old, and my mother was teaching public school in an inner-city school. My dad had gone back to university, so we were sort of left alone quite a bit of the time, and we used to constantly hang out at this racetrack. We would sneak in every day. We didn't have money to pay. And we, I think, learned some fundamental things during that whole process that, number one, I can't tell you how many times we're in situations where when doors are closed, you literally have to figure out how to get them open. And I think a lot of people in those situations tend to just hesitate. And I think at that point in life, we sort of figure out, hey, you know, the worst that you're ever going to be is sort of back outside. If you've tried, maybe you're going to get in. And we were sneaking into the track all the time. And we became sort of mascots of some of the race car crews. And, you know, it was a very exciting time of life for us.
I think we both, I hope and I feel strongly... have a fairly strong sense of fairness and honesty and compassion for other people, and but the notion of rules is an extremely arbitrary one. And as you travel around the world, and you're trying to actually document the lives of people and what affects their lives, often the rules aren't set up necessarily in a way that necessarily create the best environment for everyone. And I think I've always had a sort of sense, and it was kind of like sneaking into the Indianapolis Speedway, that as long as I'm not hurting someone, and certainly would never want to do that, that I'd, if there's a way to get into a door, I'll do my best to do it. And that spirit, I think, has sort of followed us for a long time.
Do you ever take pictures of each other?
This is Peter. I was married 7 months ago, and I had the great fortune of having my brother be one of my wedding photographers. And he created an incredible document in black and white of my wedding that I think over time becomes a lot more than simply wedding photographs.
Boy, that must have been nice. Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Photojournalists David and Peter Turnley. An exhibition of their work opens tomorrow at the International Center of Photography in New York. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli's Guilty Pleasure. This is Fresh Air. This week, with the TV season ended and summer reruns taking over, TV critic David Bianculli is calling a time out and taking a moment to reveal his biggest guilty pleasure of the past year.
What was your guiltiest TV pleasure last season? Was it Melrose Place, where the plots got ridiculous even by Melrose Place standards? Or Red Shoe Diaries, the sexy Showtime series where the plots were as transparent as the costumes? For me, it was a syndicated action series, Xena, Warrior Princess. The main culprits behind this show are Bob Tappert and Sam Raimi, who made such cult movies as the Evil Dead series and Darkman. They also were collaborators on one of my favorite non-guilty pleasures last season, the dark and moody CBS series American Gothic. But Xena is a very different animal. I'd say it's like nothing else on TV, except it's a lot like another syndicated series, one called Hercules: The Legendary Journeys. That's because both shows are made by the same team. Xena, in fact, is an official spin-off of that show. Lucy Lawless guest-starred as Xena in 3 episodes of Hercules, and was such a hit, she earned her own series as a result. Both Hercules and Xena are set in some weird, non-specific ancient era. It mixes Greek myths with Roman ones, and sprinkles in other legends and even modern idioms as well. And at its center is Xena, a woman who's as strong as many men and not afraid to fight any of them. In fact, with her war whoop cries and her no-nonsense attitude, it's obvious she enjoys it.
Enough! I don't know who or what you are, but this business is none of yours.
My name is Xena. And the way I see it, half a dozen men going after one small, defenseless boy kind of makes it my business.
Lawless, as Xena, is as good in the quiet moments as she is during the fight scenes. Here she is with guest star Kevin Sorbo, who stars on the other series as Hercules. They're on a mission to free Prometheus, who has been bound by the gods.
Hercules?
Yeah.
There's something I've been wanting to say to you for a long time. You changed my life. You taught me how to live. I'll never forget you for that. Thanks.
Well, there's something I have to tell you, too. When my wife died, I thought I'd never meet anyone again who could make me feel the way she did. But then I met you.
Oh, come on.
No, I mean it. Why do you think I told you what oracle to go see if Prometheus was ever captured? Because I knew I could trust you with that secret.
Well, I guess we're lucky to have found one another.
Yeah, we are.
Xena, Warrior Princess is not to be taken too seriously. And the politically correct TV police who would attack it for its violence are sort of stymied by the very politically correct fact that Xena, Warrior Princess has a strong female role model at its center. All I know is, I get a kick out of it, and I'm not afraid to say I enjoy watching it. You shouldn't be afraid either. Not unless you're xenophobic.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Thank you. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, Al Banks, Chris Fraley, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. We all welcome back a great intern, Phoebe Vanscoy. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.